There was a time about 100 years ago or so when Harley-Davidson was at the very cutting edge of motorcycle technology, and in terms of sales at the end of the 1920s, Harley was killing it. In 29, Harley sold the largest number of motorcycles since 1918, and those big numbers in 1918 were mainly just because of the war. But at this point, at the end of the 20s, they were selling well over 20,000 motorcycles a year without military contracts. But when the Great Depression hit, not only was nobody selling motorcycles, nobody was really innovating either. I mean, how could you afford to? That being said, companies needed to stand out if they were going to survive. The Depression would wipe out most of the American motorcycle market. And so in 1931, right at the heart of the Depression, as Harley's four founders took 50% pay cuts for the company to be able to survive their more than 80% drop in sales, William S. Harvey proposed an idea that would ultimately save Harley-Davidson and bring them into the future. An all-new engine that would not only be overhead valve instead of side valve, but also have a recirculating oil system. Harley had to change everything with this motorcycle if they were going to come out on top. Now, before we go any further in this story, I want to give a big shout out to Factor 75 for sponsoring this video. Factor 75 is basically a fully prepped meal service. You pick your meals, they show up in the mail, you heat them up, and then you go. I personally love this, especially as an alternative to takeout. Factor 75 is focused on healthy, nutritious meals, something that we rarely get from takeout or fast food, but it has that same ease. It's so convenient to just have food show up, and all you have to do is throw it in the oven, and there's no mess. I just really love this, especially with my family. Sometimes dinner rolls around, and we just haven't planned what we're going to eat, and so we don't have time to cook a huge meal, and this is just so much better because all the hard work is done for you. So if you want to spend more time riding or working on your motorcycle and less time stressing about food, check it out. If you guys are interested, I've got an awesome offer. Use my link or go to go.factor75.com and use code POGBARTJUNE50 for 50% off your first box. Once you click, my description will live update to count up all the purchases. So definitely check it out. Again, big thanks to Factor 75 for sponsoring the video, and let's jump back in. Now, prior to the knucklehead, most production motorcycles worldwide, but especially here in the United States, were powered by side valve engines. A side valve engine basically has the valves positioned in the engine block with the valve opening for the intake and the exhaust on the side of the cylinder head, whereas an overhead valve engine utilizes the valves in the head itself above the cylinder. Overhead valve engines weren't necessarily a new thing, even to the motorcycle world. I mean, Norton was already selling overhead cam engines prior to this time. Triumph was well into the whole overhead valve thing, and Harley did have some experience with small overhead valve setups, mainly in race bikes, but to make your flagship production motorcycle overhead valve at this time in the early 30s, this was quite revolutionary. The transition from side valve to overhead valve for companies like Harley and also for the British companies as well was actually a bigger and more important transition, many would argue, than the move from overhead valve to overhead cam. It's just an entirely different kind of setup when you go from side valve to overhead valve. The other thing to understand in terms of reliability and usability and maintenance is oil circulation, and here the knucklehead is one of the most revolutionary engines of its day. Sure, other companies, mainly overseas, had tackled the problem of total loss oil systems, as well as, you know, the rider having to manually regulate the oil levels, but the knucklehead was the best solution, and its impact on motorcycle technology worldwide really can't be overstated. This motorcycle was developed through the Depression, and because of that, it took a bit longer than originally expected. From inception in 1931 to its release in 1936, again, Harley was experiencing their absolute worst years through this time. The company landed on a 61 cubic inch or 1000 cc 45 degree V-twin, At this point, Harley's big twins were ballooning to over 1,300 cc's just to be able to keep up with the competition, but they knew with the transition to overhead valve versus side valve, they wouldn't need to go that big anymore. With the overhead valve setup, they could keep weight down and size down, but have a massive up in power. Now, the advantage of an overhead valve engine really is simple. It basically provides a straighter path into the engine for the fuel-air mixture and a straighter path out of the engine in terms of exhaust. Beyond that as well, though, you can also have higher compression and ultimately way more power. For the knucklehead, Harley decided to go with two valves per cylinder, operated by a train of rockers, push rods, and a cam that was mounted in the crankcase. The heads were cast iron, with the intake ports on the inside and the exhaust on the outside. The combustion chambers were hemispherical. Basically, that means that the top of the piston and the cylinder head are sort of half domes. This allows for larger valves and also really helps with heat loss. In many ways, the circulating oil system, though, would prove to be more of a problem for Harley than the transition to overhead valve and would cause delays in production as they worked to really get it right. Integrating these all new systems was difficult. You know, the overhead valve configuration and this new fully pressurized oil system, that was really the biggest challenge. 1 year after the release of the Knucklehead, Harley would make all of their side valve engines also have a fully recirculating oil system, and it wasn't as difficult to do for those motorcycles, but with this all new engine in its entirety, it was really proving to be a pickle for the company. It's important to understand also that Harley was playing catch up at this point. Indian had put a recirculating oil system on their Big Chief for 1933, and they loved advertising it as a way of showing their superiority over Harley. And Harley was sour about this. They had to do it, but they also had to do it better than Indian. For the Knucklehead, Harley went with a dry sump, meaning that basically the oil is housed in a separate tank and not in the engine sump. Again, this wasn't new for its time, but it's the execution where the Knucklehead really shines. With a dry sump setup, the biggest question is where to put that oil tank and how to keep it in line with the overall design. The rider needed to be able to access the tank, but also the tank needed to be positioned close to the pump. Indian tackled this problem by making the fuel tank split into half fuel and half oil, which is great for overall design and look. You know, you don't have this extra tank strapped anywhere, but not so great for fuel efficiency, and it called for long oil lines from that oil tank all the way down to the oil pump. So Harley decided to go the route of the British companies like Norton and Triumph by housing the oil tank under the seat, and this setup and just the way that they did it would blend form and function in a way unseen prior to this motorcycle. The U-shaped 1 gallon oil tank just blended right in with the bike. You didn't even know it was there. And this look still carries on today in some of Harley's motorcycles. The oil pump was a gear type pump, and it was really two pumps in one. There's the pressure fed pump that forces oil throughout the engine, and then there's a scavenge pump that returns oil after it's done, you know, all of its work lubricating everything, back into the tank. Matt Wachsler over at the Wheels Through Time Museum has a great video on the first year Knucklehead explaining how this oil system works.
Here's your dry sump pump here right in the back. And the way that this works, oil is fed down through the back of the oil tank to the feed line down into the lower end of the engine. A fully pressurized motor, the Knuckleheads were. So oil was pumped in through the cam cover, in through the end of the pinion shaft, lubricated your right side case bearings, actually moved through a passageway through the flywheel and lubricated the crank bearings just as well. On top of that, the overhead oil line here out of the cam cover supplies oil to the top end, lubricates valves, rocker arms, gravity feeds back down the push rods. You can actually see the drains right out of the bottom of the tappet blocks here, and it's actually fed back to the oil tank. So
now making this system work though, and work well, was easier said than done. Harley could not get the control of oil to and from the rocker arms and valves prior to the Knucklehead's 1935 targeted release. Now Harley could have just made this top end all like exposed, and then you just sort of grease up all the stuff up there periodically, like they had done with some of their overhead valve racers. But that's really not what Harley wanted for their production flagship model. They wanted it to all be automated, the entire thing, and really the key came with what would define the Knucklehead engine, which was this valve and rocker cover. Now, this innovation was late for the Knucklehead design, but it's really the thing that would define the look of the engine. But it's so much more than just a look. Basically, they designed a cover that has an upper and lower section through which oil is moved and circulated. It's all pressurized, and then once the oil is done lubricating everything on the top end, the engine vacuum sucks that oil out of the lower valve spring cover and back into the engine. The specific design of these valve covers is what gives the Knucklehead such a unique and now iconic look, and what would give it its name later on. You know, Knuckleheads weren't called Knuckleheads when they were first released, but the name is fitting as the heads look like a pair of knuckles on a fist, the clenched fist of an angry Harley owner who just spent what's left on his life savings after his divorce on a new Road Glide. Motorcycles like the Knucklehead, that is, motorcycles that change the world and ultimately save companies, well, they have to do so much more than just perform. they have to look the part as well. Motorcycles like the Suzuki GSXR 750 or the CB750, they're not just motorcycles that perform at a higher level. They have a sort of completeness to them. You get the sense that whoever designed them, whether it was a person or a team, and whoever developed the thing, went over every single part thoroughly to make it really something special, and no expense was spared. And that was the sense you got if you were in the motorcycle world in the mid-30s when the Knucklehead was released. It was one of those motorcycles. If you see a Harley today, you're seeing at least in part the DNA of the Knucklehead. So influential and beloved, just a year after the Knucklehead was released, all of Harley's models were updated to basically look like the Knucklehead. Think about the way, you know, Ducati's Panigale styling has influenced every motorcycle Ducati makes. Basically, everything in their line looks like a Panigale. It's like that. Like most motorcycles, especially at this time, the styling starts with the gas tank. For the Knucklehead, this was the biggest difference from previous models, again in terms of styling, for Harley-Davidson. The previous bikes were just more boxy, and you might not see it from just looking at a flathead from before the Knucklehead, but when you see the two lined up, you see what Harley did with this new model. It was more streamlined, the tank curved more, and its shape made it look smaller, though the fuel capacity wasn't down. This is also something unique about Harley going forward from the Knucklehead, an ability to make gas tanks that look small, and even sometimes are small. The tank flowed more from the front backward than previous models, or in Harley's example, you know, top, as their bikes kind of go from handlebars to seat, it's almost like top down. The tank was more in line with that overall line and style than before. Some like to call it organic lines, and I agree with that. And the exhaust is the same way, the way it just kind of goes down and then straight back versus some of their earlier models. But that central line of the top tube of the frame on which the components of the bike sit, that same line highlighted from the Knucklehead going forward through all of Harley's bikes, is so important for their design language. Harley learned going forward that people really like this line, you know, this simple diagonal line that defines their bikes, and they would even start integrating the seats into that line. From the rider's perspective on the Knucklehead, the center of the design is also the tank, but in a different way. An all-new instrument panel sat on the tank, integrated in an all-new way for Harley. Prior to the Knucklehead, Speedos hadn't even come standard on Harley's big twins. This was really a statement for the company, much like Vincent's big twins with their massive 150 mile per hour Speedos. This specially designed 100 mile per hour Speedo sat on a panel that was shaped kind of like a skull. I'm not sure if that was on purpose, but yeah, it definitely does look like a skull. And that top speed number would be raised to 120, as riders found that even in stock form, a Knucklehead that was tuned right could easily do 100 miles per hour and essentially, you know, bury that Speedo. The fenders were one of the few things Harley carried over, but it makes sense, you know, this new design didn't need all new fenders. They fit right in with the tank and were large enough to carry Harley's new stunning colors for the Knucklehead. This was really interesting. As I researched this, many considered the Knucklehead and its paint style as really a part of Art Deco styling, a type of design that was at its peak when the Knucklehead was released. This styling, known as Art Deco, came about between two massive global conflicts, World War I and World War II. Many consider the people of this time as the lost generation. You know, young people weren't really able to be young people, and they pretty much had no youth at this point, just because of what was going on in the world. So amidst the turmoil and the sadness and all of the death and destruction, this design movement was born. It was a movement that sought things like beauty and happiness and life and luxury and glamour. In many ways, it feels like a style meant to kind of be an escape. It was also a style that looked to the future. You know, it was inherently futuristic, and that future was meant to look brighter and happier. Though the Art Deco period, in terms of famous artwork, would kind of end at the end of the 1930s, its influence really still lives on today, and the Knucklehead, and specifically this paint job and the way it's designed, would be a sort of lasting beacon of Art Deco in the automotive world. And there's not many production motorcycles that were styled this way. You do have concept bikes like the BMW R7, which really was a bold sort of Art Deco style, but that was not a production motorcycle like the Knucklehead. Coming out of the Great Depression, though, you know, what better way to design a motorcycle than after a movement that really looks forward and celebrates the good amidst the bad? It's not just the contrasting pinstripes, it's the entire Harley logo on the tank. You know, it is a glamorous motorcycle all around, from the striking paint to, you know, the shiny pushrod covers, the chrome-plated air intake, horn, the cylinders topped with these polished, unique covers. And those who saw this bike at this time, you know, they could feel like, wow, this is really something special and awesome. The motorcycle was first unveiled in 1935 in a freaking ballroom. I just love that. It was the annual dealers convention held at the Green Room in Milwaukee's Schroeder Hotel. Little did the dealers know they were about to be shown the future of the company. The story goes that when the knucklehead was rolled out to the crowd of dealers, that they leapt to their feet and burst into prolonged cheers. Then they were all forced to sit down and watch, you know, the entire lineup displayed for the 36th year. But when it was all over, every single one of them clambered up on stage to look at this all-new motorcycle, Harley's new big, but also little flagship twin. This thing felt special, you know, it felt all new, but very little of this motorcycle was pointing back. Wasn't much of it pointing back to the good old days of Harley strapping an engine to a bicycle. Besides the kickstart, you know, with the giant pedal attached to it. Why does a kickstart need a pedal? Have you ever thought about that? Regardless, Harley knew that they had something special, a bike that they knew performed. They knew it was the best production motorcycle that they'd ever made by a long shot, but now their suspicions were confirmed. They'd also designed something truly beautiful and special, the kind of motorcycle that really turns heads. But at the same time, Harley was ramping up production to be ready for this new model. Still, production problems abounded even after the oiling was fixed. Models would be, you know, made on the assembly line, sent off to testers, and then returned with problems. But finally, in 1936, the bike was released, and it cost a whopping $380. If I could go back in time and buy something, I'd buy, like, a couple knuckleheads, probably. The production knucklehead made about 40 horsepower and weighed 515 pounds. Sure, it was no Triumph Speed Twin at this time, a bike that would come out about a year later, but it was astounding, and its role as sort of the ultimate touring machine in America was obvious. It really did perform. It was sort of carrying on that lasting legacy of American touring motorcycles, motorcycles that could now very reliably handle, you know, 80, 70 miles an hour and could also just cruise forever. It came standard with a 4-speed transmission, and that year roughly 2,000 knuckleheads were sold, which was really good numbers for them. They hardly didn't think it would sell quite that much. And the model would be updated significantly through its 10-year-ish run, even as it survived World War II, and also a 74 cubic inch version of the knucklehead would be released during this time. And by the end of its run, you know, the knucklehead would make up over half of Harley's yearly sales. In 47, its last year, some 11,000 models were sold. Harley's engine history is interesting, and we've differentiated often between models prior to and after the 61 overhead valve that we call the knucklehead, you know, the flathead, the knucklehead, the panhead, the shovelhead, ironhead. But in all reality, switches like the knucklehead to the pan and so on, those weren't really the end of the knucklehead. It's just an evolution of that overhead valve design. As one writer puts it, there's a lot more in common than different between, you know, the knucklehead engine and even today's liquid-cooled overhead cam Harley engines. I think it's easy to forget what time period the knucklehead came from. This bike came to exist out of a time of gloom and hopelessness. Its inception was literally born during Harley's worst year ever. But you just don't get that sense when you look at it. It feels like a bike that looked forward into the future, which is really the only place to look in times like this. Now, we've talked quite a bit, and a lot of people talk about Harley's future, and no doubt Harley talks amongst itself about its own future. And I'll be completely honest with you, I have no clue and no answers as to what the future is or how they can propel themselves forward as an American company. On the one hand, they have to look forward, and for many, it's assumed that technical innovation is the way forward, or maybe switching to electric, or, you know, things like liquid cooling or more tech-focused products. On the other hand, as an American company with loads of heritage, they absolutely have to look back. Maybe the answer lies in this story, you know, a story of Harley pulling themselves out of the worst of times with a single great motorcycle. I don't know what that motorcycle would look like today. Maybe you do. Let us know in the comments below. Be sure to subscribe if you guys enjoy this kind of video. And yeah, we'll see you in the next one. Ride safe.